Welcome to the Breaking Health Podcast, a series of discussions with the most disruptive CEOs and leaders in digital health.
Welcome to this special edition of the Breaking Health Podcast. In today's episode, we'll hear a panel conversation from the recent DHIS event. Nancy Brown, a partner at Oak HCFT, moderates this conversation about women, families, and health, understanding the market, its impact, and how to measure success. Let's listen in.
I had the honor of putting together this panel. It should be called Nancy's Favorite People Panel. So I so appreciate the panelists coming. We're going to run through this for about 30 minutes, and then we're going to want you to ask questions. And really the hope of today is to go through and talk about women and families and health and talk about the business of this, because these are really, really distinct companies. And then we have the honor of having a health plan here to represent sort of the buyer and the interests of many members, the largest health plan in Boston. So I'm going to start and I'm going to ask one of my favorite questions, which is, these are incredibly talented people who could be doing anything they want, and they could be running any companies they want to on any subject and taking jobs, and they've had many, many impressive jobs. And here they sit in their specific roles. And some of these are going to feel a little bit more towards the entrepreneurs, but I want you to obviously chime in on all of this. And so just really start, we'll start with Neil, and just talk about, and I just know too much about you, so I could actually answer this question for you. But Neil came to Maven working with Atul Gawande and coming out of the not-for-profit section and being an OB. And I think the day I met you and we talked about you joining, I said something which are like, shut up, are you kidding? Like, this is going to be amazing. So I'd love to hear and love for you to share, why on earth did you go from your prestigious academic role and being a physician to joining a for-profit, venture-backed women's health company?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we're all friends here. So it was a midlife crisis and a pandemic on we probably. But I think it's pretty rare in life where you have a cinematic moment that like totally changes your worldview. But I honestly had one. So you don't know the story. But like in like March, April 2020, I was a forward deployed clinician delivering babies and all of our beds were full. We couldn't test people. There was no rapid testing. You could only do it in the hospital. It took hours. We didn't have enough PPE. It was different then. And one of your jobs as an on-call OB is to answer phone calls. So people would call from the community, sick, pregnant, and they'd want to know if they could come into the hospital or not. And somebody called me from Chelsea, which is in the greater Boston area, very different from Chelsea, New York, one of the most impoverished parts of the greater Boston area. And she was clearly sick, but didn't meet the triaging criteria to come into the hospital. And so I gave her the advice that I was supposed to, which was to self-isolate, and she couldn't because she had kids and she lived with her parents. And I still don't know what happened to her, but it was like very clear to me in that moment. It was kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back or whatever, but it was like health is not produced in the four walls of my hospital. It's produced in people's homes and their communities and their workplaces. And so that like really affected me. And then like, you know, I'd talked to Kate off and on since she started the company many years ago, was enormously skeptical because you cannot deliver a baby through a screen, you know? But had tracked all of the progress, and you all got to hear from Kate, you know how incredible she is. So when she was looking for a chief medical officer, I don't think she knew what a chief medical officer was, and I'm not sure I did either, but we kind of converged on something that seemed really exciting. And in blowing up my whole career, giving away my grants, all of that, I watched Atul Gawande kind of do it first with a lot of earned wisdom, actually. And one of the things that he told me, which I'll pass on to anybody for any life moment or inflection point, is to be intentional about what you set aside to move into a new space, what you bring with you, and what you newly adopt. And so I'm no longer the person that gets to comment publicly when the CDC puts out new data necessarily. I'm not the objective neutral observer. But I brought my whole research team from Harvard with me. We've committed at Maven Clinic to putting all of our outcomes through peer review and having scientific integrity in a space that needs more of it. And I'm learning how to be a business operator in real time.
And we're grateful for that. Lori, one of my favorite entrepreneurs. You've been around the industry for a little while, like me, and you've landed in this really wonderful new venture. So why don't you explain why? Yeah. Why, when you could have done anything, you're doing this?
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And I remember when we met in 2004, I think it was. So we've been doing this a long time.
We were 15.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm the CEO and co-founder of Caraway. Caraway is fundamentally changing the way Gen Z experiences healthcare by addressing their mental, physical, and reproductive healthcare needs all in one place. And there's an unprecedented need and crisis. Gen Z, our focus is 18 to 29. They lack access to care. They lack a trusted consumer experience that meets their technology-forward, mobile-first expectations. They're excluded from their healthcare decision-making, and the healthcare system isn't meeting their need. And I was experiencing this firsthand with three nieces the time last year between 18 and 23, just facing a daunting time and a challenging time getting the care that they need. And the more that I peeled the onion and realized that the world around me, so many friends with kids turning 18, going to school, and navigating these same incredible challenges, the more I realized that the care has to meet their behaviors. And it wasn't. And it was an incredible realization that there was opportunity to innovate. And the other realization I had in living and breathing their adulting and never-ending challenges to access the care that they needed was how piecemeal everything was. And that's been a little bit of a theme here today. And that, you know, the holistic approach and the integration is a core value of Caraway. It's not an add-on. It is core to who we are in being able to provide a holistic solution. And then I think the last part of the why, sort of the just ambition and the passion, is that I have been doing this a long time, and I think trying to redefine healthcare for an entire generation, which is what our ambition is, I think that will lead to Gen Z demanding systemic change from the healthcare system. And that's a big ask, but I really feel that that could happen.
No, I love that. We need, by the way, can you cancel all the other sessions? Because we need hours to unpack all this. I was just thinking that when I invested in Maven, I originally invested because I thought it was millennial females at the time that were going to really fundamentally change the way they would accept healthcare. And so, yes, it happened to be about women's health and all of that, but it was that they were just no longer going to accept, you know, getting the care management calls from the health plan disconnected from all their actual care and all the rest of it. So I see now, I'm glad you've got the next generation ready for us. So that's terrific. Angela, thanks for coming.
Thank you. So I am here because 30 years of being a nurse, over 30 now, it really maternity focused and interested in advocating for the underserved. And so working at Lucena Analytics gives me that opportunity to take that into the next level and understand how analytics can impact care and how it can be actionable. And I think this unique opportunity, because we're part of a bigger organization called Unified Women's Healthcare, which is one of the largest provider, OBGYN provider organizations in the United States, is to understand how we can take those analytics, match that with the coordination that's needed in the fragmentation, and then have it redesign the maternity experience. And being part of that provider network is really key as well. I think that hasn't necessarily been touched on a little bit with Maven because of the virtual, but the brick and mortar that's still out there and they're doing the deliveries every day, and how do we impact that piece? So that was what drove me to come to this part of my career.
You want to talk about Lucena?
Yeah, so Lucena is an interesting, we are a maternity analytics company. you know, I think someone earlier, it may have been Kate, that was talking about the challenges in the Medicaid population and actually finding those women and finding those pregnancies. And so we have been able over the last 7 years to really fine tune the ability to data mine and look for those pregnancies where they don't take the normal path of care. And not only that piece, but then to real time and everyday risk stratify, because pregnancies have such a dynamic change and you have the short period of time to make impact. And so again, making data actionable, how can I put that type of very empowering data in the hands of those individuals that are doing the outreach, that are doing the coordination, that are actually the providers of care, and change the path for these outcomes, because we know that we're not doing the best job right now. We still see those numbers going up for preterm birth rate, for unfortunately the maternal morbidity and mortality. So that's our goal and mission, is to really have that North Star impact on moms and babies.
Perfect. So we're going to come back through. We're going to start with Sukhana and talk about, this is a really great setup for this panel to have the head of innovation from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts here, because the next really wave through, we'll be talking about how people measure success, who pays for these services, you know, are they nice to have? When I did Maven originally and we did Unified, people were like, that's, you know, is there an ROI? Like, how do you think about this? We started out investing in this space during the Me Too movement and moved through all the movements. And I'm hoping that none of these movements, I mean, I don't mind if they move market, but I want solid ROIs from buyers and solid experiences from end users. So we're going to narrow your job down to sort of the areas sort of represented here, but you're going to keep us honest in sort of talking about how you think about these kinds of services. How do you prioritize them? How do you measure them?
Sure. Good afternoon, everyone. So this is an area that's growing in interest for us as a plan, and I think for other plans more broadly. And I would say there's starting to be a theme where we're going from, as insurers, looking at innovators from the lens of the conditions that they treat, because frankly, that's historically how we've focused our ROI, and it's been more of an in-year ROI. It's an in-year benefit design model, unfortunately. And so that's how we've historically focused our efforts, and there's been a real emphasis on trying to improve cost of care and improve affordability. And so that's still a primary focus for us, no question. And yet, what I think we're starting to see is a slow shift towards saying, how do we look at individuals more holistically from the standpoint of their collection of experiences, and how do we help address that? And why is that? Because if we can't do that, we can't necessarily get all the data that we need to help identify the right people. When we identify them, we don't necessarily have the right to influence them. We don't have the trust that we need with them. And then we can't have a hope of trying to drive adoption. And so women's health in particular is an area that is of growing interest to us. We're trying to find ways now to figure out how might we become the best plan for women. And you could argue whether we have the right to play there. But part of the logic there is, of course, you know, we know all the stats in terms of the population and women being major decision makers and so forth. There's a logic here which says, if I want to get to folks and I want to help address their needs from an equity standpoint, from an experience standpoint, from a quality standpoint, from an affordability standpoint, I've got to get to the right folks. And women, typically, because they are the key decision maker, are critical on that front, number one. Number two, I got to find a way to cut through the clutter, because there's so much stuff out there, it's just really hard to break through. And so when you start to try to find what are the moments that matter, many of the moments that matter actually relate to women. It's when you have a child or you're trying to conceive. It's when your child goes from a pediatrician to a PCP. It's when you're diagnosed with a disease. It's when a family member is diagnosed with the disease. It's when you're dealing with caregiving. I mean, the list goes on, but there are like two handfuls of major moments that matter where you have an opportunity to make a difference. and women sit at the center of it. And so we're trying to take a more holistic view, and we're hearing from a customer standpoint, from employers, that there's a desire to try to help with fertility benefits. That's one of our top areas of interest from our employers, in addition to mental health. They're looking for mental health. Increasingly, we're looking for gender-affirming services. We're looking for ways in which we can help address menopause and perimenopause, which is growing. So that hopefully gives you a little bit of a flavor. And so in terms of success metrics, yes, we're always going to look at cost of care and how can we bend trend. That's part of our fiduciary responsibility as payer. But then related to that is, where and how are we driving experience? And in some cases, is there a revenue uplift opportunity with buy-ups? And then we're looking for ways in which we can improve quality and outcomes. And we're looking for ways in which we can address equity. Everybody's talking about equity. Maternal health is one of the areas the Blue Cross Association in particular has zeroed in on as a major use case for improvement.
Thank you. And I always try, at least try my best, to get behind the story. You know, so there's a lot of complexity, and I think I'll talk about Maven more than I probably should, just because it's what I'm most familiar with. But Maven went from direct to consumer to employer, to then it went through payers, but payer distributed to employers, so really ASO business, so it's the same. And then now is part of the benefit. And Kate didn't touch on this morning, but we lived through the, you know, incorporating something like Maven into a maternity benefit and having problems come up like, wait, you do postpartum depression? Oh, we carved out mental health. So we can't figure, like, we don't want to pay twice for that. So just an incredible, that's just one artifact. There's many, many artifacts of, like, it becomes really difficult to go from a traditional care management model or traditional benefit model to sort of adding some of these new benefits in. And then we also run into a tremendous problem around our Medicaid moms in that, you know, at least I'm sure other investors in the room would love to do more investing in this space, but the vast majority of the benefit goes to the baby and keeping the baby out of the NICU, and it's not a combined, you know, it's not a bundled payment. And so I have wonderful, probably very good friends of Neil's and others, friends that are in this space that are in nonprofit hospitals saying to me, like, as a venture capitalist, don't do it. Like, don't do it. Like, you will go broke in this business. And then trying to get CMMI or whoever we should go to or the Blues to figure out, like, can we do an experiment? Can we do? So I just bring this up because there are some real life challenges that go on in fundamentally starting to change, you know, what we're doing. And I like that your list is everything from sort of marketing, you know, and all the way through to actually hardcore ROI. So let's dive in a little bit, because the other thing, and actually Kate did bring this up, which is whenever you hear about these services, you think, oh my gosh, like, who wouldn't want these? Neil told me standing over there that, you know, because he's an OB, he gets all the calls. You know, I work with Zeke Emanuel, he's an oncologist, he gets all the calls. So you just, sometimes they come to these businesses just to make people stop calling them. So they'll say, go on Maven, like, you don't have to call me about your questions. But what's actually shocking to me is how hard it is to get people on the platform. And in some cases we've got, so, you know, coming out of Lucina, which is, you know, I just to make sure everyone's clear about this, and I just love this product because it is, you know, we don't need generative AI. We just need a little, you know, a little analysis. They go through and they find all of these moms that are, I'll simplify this probably and you'll correct me, but they find moms that are pregnant before the health plan has identified them, and they take that list along with a risk stratification, clinical risk stratification, and a care plan and hand it to the care managers at the health plan. And that just seems like a phenomenal thing. But that engagement of those members or those women is really, really difficult. And it's the same thing when we offer benefits through, you know, through an employer. It is incredibly difficult to actually get people to sign up. In the case of, I think, all of these services, once they do, I think they're sticky as heck, but they're really, really difficult. So I'm leading the witness a little bit because of the time we have, but that to me has been a big focus of all of our tech-enabled service companies, which is how to get people enrolled. And maybe we'll just start, because we left you for last, to say, what is the health plan, what does your health plan feel like? What is their responsibility? After you put one of the companies through a year analysis, if we're lucky, and we get anointed, and then what is your point of view about promotion of these, and is that your spot? Is that your role?
It's a great question. So we are concerned about adoption and engagement, and it's something we're tracking much more closely now. Initially, it was like, oh, we offer all these things on the shelf, and that was sufficient. And clearly, it's no longer sufficient. And we're not doing our full duty unless we're able to help drive adoption. And yet, you referenced it earlier, Nancy, people don't always think about their plan as an option, and we don't necessarily have the right to inform. And frankly, even when we have good phone numbers, et cetera, not everybody answers a phone anymore. And so we're looking at omnichannel opportunities and doing more push, text, et cetera, and using our app. But we're starting to think about ways in which we can get a little bit more creative to break through. So two things. One, on the more creative angle, and this literally, I was just brainstorming this with our sales team yesterday as we're talking to a major account about actually women's health-related issues and how we could help drive adoption there, is might we get the employee resource groups, the women's employee resource group of that employer involved? Because they have a different level of relationship with their teams, and it's run by employees who care, and get the word out that way. Because otherwise, when we spam people with stuff, like, it's kind of scattershot, and the results are uneven in terms of your ability to actually break through. So that's one. The second is less creative per se, but essential, and that's around what's the relationship like with the PCP and or the physician who is the main relationship driver for those cohorts for whom that's relevant. Now, for Gen Z, it's a different dynamic, and so we're aware of that, and we're trying to figure that out. But that's been tricky for us. Like, we physicians right now, if I can, at the risk of generalizing, are overwhelmed, and they've got a lot going on, and they need payer-agnostic solutions, and so it's a little tricky to find ways to break through. But that's something we've been toying with and playing with in terms of deeper relationships with select providers. So, for example, we have a relationship with Firefly, and with Firefly, which is a more non-traditional virtual PCP, we're really working with them and with folks who are unattributed to a PCP to say, when you call in, let's get you in, and we'll get you in a week. And that, too, we're still working on adoption, to be perfectly candid.
But it's I won't get into the details, but it's an unprecedented kind of contract. Yes. So thank you for that leadership there. So I led the witness by saying, you know, getting people onto the platform and using it is the problem. But I'll let you can redirect if there's another. I'm trying to get to, like, what's been the biggest surprise in terms of what's the most difficult to do? And, you know, the usual, what keeps you up at night? Again, for me, with my companies, it's enrollment. We can start anywhere.
A lot keeps us up at night. I think that, you know, one is just the nimbleness and humility it takes to really continually try to match Gen Z behaviors with care needs. And we've learned so much about their behaviors. It's a big transitional point at 18, navigating healthcare for the first time on your own. It's an age when a lot of diagnoses pop up, chronic conditions, a lot of mental health, reproductive health. The technology side of things I mentioned, if we're not able to respond, right, on a 24/7 basis and respond to the question or have a chat interaction or an on-demand visit or scheduled, often, you know, members turn to TikTok and Google without good outcomes, like no kidding. And they're really sort of skeptical of the healthcare system. They're sort of deeply skeptical of it, whether it's gender biases, just LGBTQIA biases, from a health equity perspective. And sort of earning that trust is a really important part of the puzzle for us. And so there's just this real need to match our services to their values and really prove that to them. And it's a big part of our engagement model. And we have a program called Caraway Crew that is literally hundreds of women across the country that really help support our awareness building and enrollment on the ground.
Like influencers.
Yes, exactly. And it's really sort of incredible. And it's a big piece of what we worry about. We also just worry about meeting the demand. I mean, there is incredible acuity and need on the mental health side, especially, and the reproductive health side. And the reproductive health restrictions are devastating, and they're further escalating the mental health challenges. And there's a lot of acuity. I mean, we have like PHQ-9 and GAD-7 scores, like, you know, really high, like 70% of our members. And so just being able to address that, and oftentimes, you know, meeting the members in that need, like in that moment of need, because that's when they're going to engage with us.
And it's truly, this is really emerging market, right?
Yep.
So you're creating a market. I mean, other people have, but they're sort of further along. Yep. And we've talked about this because anyone who's got kids that age or kids in college know that there's a huge gap. And in fact, everyone on the stage represents the gap in the current system that exists, a gap that a lot of people don't recognize. And I think what was surprising to me, and we've talked about this, is that the universities don't actually want to be responsible. I was like, oh, this will be great. You can put it out through the universities, but they don't want the risk of it. And so there's also, you're dealing with your own ecosystem of people pushing against this, or not at least being able to promote it. It's very interesting. I just watched my daughter when she, doing a panel at Georgetown, and they asked about mental health services and other services, and the kids were so skilled in how they said, the university does nothing, but we help each other. That basically, they said that in the most polite way possible, but it was true.
Well, it's you mentioned sort of almost like influencers, this sort of on-the-ground engagement program, but they really do, they want real doctors and nurses and clinicians that are practicing evidence-based medicine, and they're, you know, 24/7. First and foremost, they also really want to hear about it from their friends, which is your point. They really sort of talk to their friends. And I think our struggle is, I think, the multiple pathways that exist from 18 to 29. I mean, this is all about a developmental stage that's really crucial for identity formation and growing up. And there's lots of different ways to engage in care and give members what they need. And we, you know, we're struggling. We have 8 months of operation. So we've started seeing patients 8 months ago. So we're still little but mighty. And for us, I think figuring out the balance of virtual care in the traditional sense with a lot of the sort of skills building we've built into our app, where we've tried to really deconstruct, especially on the mental health side, all the evidence around ACT and CBT and the alphabet soup, and actually put it back together in a way that is accessible to Gen Z.
I'd love to riff on that, because, yeah, you know, Lori's like 8 months and we're like 8 years in, and the same things keep me up at night. And I also want to amplify two things. Like, Nancy, you said that you got into this because you thought millennials would lead the revolution. And honestly, they continue to, because millennials are going through menopause, and that's why I have an at bat at that right now. Right? When you were like kind of recruiting me over to Maven, I was like, I think Maven should go into menopause. And you're like, really? You think that's a thing that we could do? And like, here we are, right? And it was because of that foresight, and hopefully Gen Z is right behind them. But what keeps me up at night fundamentally is the trustworthiness of our health system. And that's not like a virtue only. That is an output of a system that's either working or not working for people that you can operationalize. When I think about all of the populations that don't trust in the health system because they're young and skeptical, or what, you know, and they've actually lived through a lot, Gen Z, during their period of coming into age, or all of the issues that we deal with collectively on this panel are at the intersection of gender inequity, racial inequity, geographic inequity, like this generational inequity, like, you know, the spiciest topics in America today. You have to be able to affirm people, first of all, and sometimes that comes through peer groups. In Medicaid, for us, it requires boots on the ground, working with faith-based communities. You know, the reason like Maven is good at enrolling people is because we only get paid when we enroll people. Like, we're not a PMPM. Right. And, but you have to be able to affirm people to do it. The second thing that you have to be able to do extremely well is reliably show up for people when they expect you to, which is what the brick and mortar system will always be bad at. I think collectively in the room, we have an opportunity to be more precise about what digital health is and it isn't. It's not Zooming with somebody. It's showing up for them when they're struggling to breastfeed at 3 a.m., or it's if they're in the Delta region of Arkansas and they have gestational diabetes, if you can look through their phone at the refrigerator and help them plan a meal with a dietitian, that's the difference between a 34-week delivery and a 39-week delivery and months in the NICU. And then the third thing you have to do, which collectively we haven't been good at either, is just to be competent and to show that. Like, we're not splitting the atom at Maven Clinic. Like, we're literally just I probably shouldn't. We're not. Like, we're finding people who need more care and support. We're giving it to them. And then we're like holding ourselves accountable to measuring what happens and putting our money where our mouth is and putting our fees at risk.
So I know you said we could use an hour. We really could. So we're a little, you know, we are not a B2C, and our clients are health plans and payers. And so the challenges that we have are really getting them to understand how this data is actionable and what do you do with it. And it's changing the way of what has been very traditional case management. If someone has a hypertension diagnosis, that means they're high risk and I need to engage them in case management. What Lucina has been very good at doing is actually looking across a million mom-baby matches and able to then really look at and learn from not just one condition, but multiple conditions and how those actually impact that preterm birth rate. And so when you can get in front of those individuals that are going to use the tool and the platform and explain to them, it's not just one diagnosis anymore. And I'm not saying that the hypertensive pregnant person isn't the one you want to target for outreach and make that priority, but it's usually a combination and that includes social determinants as well. And so what the tool is really great at doing is giving you a risk score that combines all those in, and it's specific to that market. So how does the mom in California, how does that pregnancy differ and impact it versus, you know, rural Georgia as an example. And so if you can get them to understand that it's not just a diagnosis any longer, and it's not just the one path, and how to connect them to those services and use the tool, I think that stickiness starts to happen because they're like, oh, okay, so because her risk score is 90, you know, I understand now how this has a prevalence and a priority for outreach and engaging them, and also connecting them to the right types of services is really important because we look for over 80 different conditions. And so when you're able to do that, you can really focus and target individually what their needs are. Is it a mental health support? You know, is it something else that a substance use provider and a program that maybe the health plan has? So I think when you sit down and show them how you can use it and prioritize, because those resources at the health plan are, you know, very precious resources. They're very expensive resources. And if you can connect them to those other programs, I think that's where you start to see the outcomes and the impact and then the ROI. And then you get the stickiness and they understand that it's not just the cookie cutter way we used to do case management, you know, 5 years ago.
So, oh my gosh, there's just too much to talk about. But I think that in all these cases, they're all actionable, right? So I think the days of just giving people a website to go to or, you know, some information or surfacing things and then not completing it is probably what led me not only to go from medical to mental health, but to social determinants of health investing, because all these things have to come together seamlessly. And I get people all the time showing me companies that are like, look, we surface to the patient that they need all these things. And I'm like, and then what happens? And they're like, well, then they go get them somewhere, you know, somehow. So that is that, and I don't think I'll ever run or invest in a pure analytics company again, with all due respect to anyone out there. I'm only ones that use analytics as a means to an end. And Lori and I have had our scars of doing that. So, and I love that about how actionable it is, and how they're using just data that's just sitting around and getting that point of view. We are 7 minutes left, 7 minutes between us and your lunch. So I'm going to go to you in 1 minute, everyone in the audience, for questions. So please have them. But I want to talk about the other sort of surprise that I've had, which is value-based payments. So I came out of a staff model HMO. Everyone knows that. I've never stopped talking about it. That was by define. We were value-based payments. We paid ourselves. It's been my sort of life's pursuit, and I've been shocked at how little there is actually going on. This state I think Blue Cross Blue Shield in Massachusetts is a standout and always has been. But it's just amazing to me how many of my companies show up at the payer's door with a, you know, fairly sophisticated view and then end up going back to fee-for-service plus because the payer doesn't, it's just too complicated, or they don't really want to get into it. Just love to get, since we have the occasion of having you here, your thoughts on that.
I would agree, Nancy. I mean, I think there's great promise with value-based payment models, and yet we haven't fully realized the promise. And even in a state like Massachusetts, where we've got very high penetration of value-based care, and Blue Cross of Mass, as you've noted, was a pioneer in initiating that. If you really take a hard-nosed look at it, while academic studies will suggest that we were able to perhaps mitigate some trend increase, it's not like it's translated into a step change in terms of affordability. And we're already in a very sophisticated provider market, so the quality levels were already quite high here. And so that's not to poo-poo it, it's just to say that there's a lot of untapped potential. And there is an opportunity for us even to further enhance the model. So for Blue Cross of Mass, while we have like over 80% of our providers in value-based payment models today, you know, the incentives go to the system, right? And they don't go down to the frontline clinicians and physicians. And there's been more of a focus on primary care, which is much needed, as we know, but a lot of the costs and activity are with specialists. So there's some challenges there. As it relates to your point of various innovators coming to the table saying, we'll go at risk and we'll... Part of the challenge is it's like, how many times do I double, triple, and quadruple count the risk? And so that becomes an issue. And how do I attribute that? And so there's a lot of mechanics to kind of work through that get a bit challenging.
Absolutely. Questions? Microphones?
Coming your way.
We have a cluster right here. There's very smart people.
Thank you. I'm Victor, a physician, and running a HMO startup. It's funny because today in the morning I was with my team discussing maternity and childbirth within our HMO. And I just want to share the context and see if you guys see a similar thing happening. Maternity business doesn't seem like a good business to general hospitals. So a lot of maternity hospitals concentrate and become like an oligopoly and monopoly, like very few companies concentrating all the childbirth. When there is an oligopoly or monopoly, the incumbents have less incentive to innovate, and it's hard to work with them. On the other hand, all the women want to have birth there because there's the brand of the maternity, etc. And we see, I think because most women are postponing childbirth, etc., and motherhood, the increase of the prevalence of more complex childbirth and more ICU in charge for perinatal care, etc., for child. So it's been a complex equation, how to get the maternities to innovate and to do value-based care and to really be concerned about it because they don't really need it because it's very concentrated. On the other hand, cases become more complex, the prevalence of more complex childbirth getting higher. So just want to hear about
it. I'm like chomping at the bit. It's not that complicated, actually. So first of all, childbirth is 25% of all hospitalizations in the country, which cumulatively is 0.6% of GDP. You take the whole GDP of the country, spread it out across this table, and you can see the cost of hospitalizing moms and babies with your naked eye. Huge part of spend. And it's also the body's first physiologic stress test, so you unmask a ton of chronic conditions through it, and it's episodable. So the opportunity in the brick and mortar system is complicated. And that's where I spent most of my career. Wrote a textbook on value-based care with lots of maternity examples in it.
Oh, please. What's the name of the book?
It's called Understanding Value-Based Care. From McGraw-Hill. It's like the textbook on value-based care. Awesome. And didn't Thank have you. To operate a business that was trying to deliver it until relatively recently. But in the digital world, you have an opportunity to step back, look at the incentives, and align them. So, for example, nobody wants IVF. Nobody. I told Nancy that I would try to get at least like one audible gasp. Like, but literally nobody wants. What people want is the shortest pathway to a healthy baby. Period. And so it's actually the only area of healthcare where you have such a clear objective function. So my job at Maven is to deliver that. Otherwise, I should just go home, right? And so like what we're doing is among the fertility population, which by the way is driving a lot of the complex pregnancies, we've committed to a natural conception rate. We're like, do you have irregular periods? Let's learn more about that. And maybe you need a $5 thyroid medication. And if they do, that's what we do, right? And then what we're doing is we're looking at fertility and maternity end to end, and then managing the care because it turns out in a 15-minute punctuated visit, Despite all of the glass and steel that's being raised around Boston, you can't get that much done. What people really need is support around the really hard things, like changing their diet when they have gestational diabetes.
Great, thank you.
Let's just go to another question here quickly.
Oh, you? Okay. All right. Hi, I am Sharon Marable, and I'm primary care in public health, and I'm pleased to be here. And my question is that I'm sure that you know all of the public health data regarding Black women dying and having severe complications during pregnancy. So I was wondering if any of you can comment how your programs have had an impact regarding Black women's maternal child health issues.
I've had the mic too much, but I mean, it's not just that there's racism intersecting with maternal health. It's that maternal health is the leading indicator of structural racism in America, alongside incarceration rates and educational attainment. It's terrible. And so an app isn't going to fix structural racism, but that's not what we're doing. What we're doing is we're taking the device in people's pockets and we're using it as a portal into a human service that is affirming. And what we see is actually among our Black members across our whole book of business, including Medicaid, utilization rates are actually much higher across every vertical, like OBs, but also doulas. And I think that's a factor, that's a product of two things. One, the barriers that exist in the brick and mortar world geographically. But when you untether access from geography, you can do pretty incredible things. And so we have committed to not just publishing our outcomes, but stratifying it by race. And we have a ton of work to do. But I'm really proud of the fact that at least where access is a primary issue, like mental health, we're seeing parity in our outcomes.
And I would just add that backing up, you know, pre-maternal, pre-childbirth, and thinking about access to contraception, and just you know, the data that we're seeing when we're working with historically Black colleges and universities, for example, is that, you know, there's a stunning disparity. And there's, I'm not going to get this stat exactly right, but it's in the 70% of BIPOC women feel just disregarded by their clinicians when they talk about their healthcare concerns. I mean, it's just an overwhelming statistic. And I think access to contraception is just as bad. I mean, there's today, and this is compounded with the reproductive health restrictions, but this is like in the 80% range of 16 to 27 year olds have difficulty getting access to contraception and in fact can't get their next refill. I mean, it's just an overwhelming need that we have ahead of us. And so we're at Caraway prioritizing the population.
And I would just quickly add that at Blue Cross of Mass, we are tracking health outcomes by race, and we're publishing it. And we are allocating incentive dollars to physician groups based on their ability to improve their areas where they are below and where there are clear health disparities based on race. So it's a big area of focus for us. We've just initiated that. And then maternal health, particularly Black maternal health, is one of the key use cases relative to equity. Everyone's talking about equity, but we've got to find some specific areas to focus that the Blue Cross Association has targeted as key for us to turn the dial on.
So I want to thank everyone. I'm sorry we don't have time for more questions, but I want to thank the panelists. I'm honored that you all took time to come today and that we got to talk about this and got to talk about it twice in the morning. So thank you very much.